Many of you who have been here last 2 weeks or last two lectures, you already know the two experts who are going to be sharing with us the subject on artificial intelligence very kindly, Monsieur Jean-Gabriel Castel and Mathieu Castel. They led the discussion, and I'm not going to say any more, but I know there will be some people walking in late, so.
Cool.
All right. Perfect. Monsieur Castel.
So, thanks for everyone who's come again and visited us in our third installment here, and welcome to new people joining us. So, as we mentioned, we're going to be really sort of focusing on how emerging technologies are reshaping society and ourselves. So we're going to sort of offer some final thoughts today, and just sort of before we kind of get into what we're going to chat about today, I wanted to just kind of do a quick recap. I mean, I think that there's a couple of new faces here. For those of you who are just joining, in the last two sessions, we've really been looking at the increasingly unstable world that we currently live in, where economic inequality, societal polarization as well, are really being exacerbated by the fact that society is not keeping pace with technological change. So we also, throughout the course of the last two lectures, we're going to kind of put things into perspective, offering the observation that society has really been asking this question for quite a long time. This isn't new. Society's been really sort of focused on whether or not machines are going to displace humans. And so what we kind of found and sort of looked over in the last couple of lectures was really that a robot may or may not be coming for our jobs, but what's really going to be important is to kind of focus on lifelong learning and adaptability. And then we also looked at, we found that sort of the practicalities of lifelong learning are very daunting. We looked into the sort of concept of how lifelong learning is being put into practice through new sort of training schools. We also looked at massive open online courses. We also looked at also how technology is shaping geography. So we looked at self-driving cars, we looked at cities as innovation hubs, and we found that to really prosper and succeed in the new digital era, the spirit of openness to new ideas, to new people is going to be very critical. So that really leads us to tonight, where we're going to focus first on the international aspects of artificial intelligence, and I'll pass things over to Mr. Castel here.
Good evening. Glad to see you still have a few aficionados. Well, in recent years, the rapid development of artificial intelligence and its use in fully and partially autonomous robots, drones, and other machines, particularly in regional conflicts and civil war, like in Syria at the moment, it has been of concern to a number of scientists, engineers, philosophers, and publics at large. So another thing is that in a not too distant future, you could have autonomous machines of general human or superhuman intelligence, and they would pose a risk of existential threat to the human race. This is why international dialogue, cooperation, and partnership must address the challenges caused by created by the new digital technology. Now, what I'm going to do this first half hour is to look first at the weaponization of codes in cyber attacks via the internet by states, individuals, and also by terrorists. And I'm going to look at both the civil aspect and the criminal aspect of this type of weaponization. Then I will consider whether the use of fully or partially autonomous lethal, and I insist on the word lethal, weapons, systems, on the ground, in the air, under the water, and even in space, are able to meet international human rights obligations. This is the big issue in international law, is to determine the extent to which these artificial intelligence machines can apply the rules of international human rights? Can a killer robot be programmed with moral and ethical rules similar to those of humans? And then I shall conclude by determining whether international law can control. What can we do to control these machines? Now, before I do that, I just want to make a few remarks. First of all, to tell you that lethal autonomous and semi-autonomous weapons raise a lot of issues. I cannot cover them all, but technical issues, military issues, legal issues, moral and ethical questions. Now, we're not going to deal, Matt and I, with ethics and morality, because we have already done so in part when I was dealing with the legal profession, the medical profession, and also with the case of autonomous cars. Now, there is a consensus that on the importance of applying international law. Everyone agrees on that. And also in international humanitarian law and human rights law. But there is no yet any accord as to what these rules should be. Lethal, fully autonomous weapon system, fortunately, do not yet exist. But people are working on it, and very soon we're going to have to face them. Now, autonomy in the military sphere, autonomous technology like missiles, drones, mine searchers, and also in the case of persons who are on the field, humans on the field of battle, and then you will have those robots coming to pick you up, or also, for instance, what happened in Japan at the time when there was this atomic catastrophe. And there, the robots would be very important because they can go where humans cannot go. Also, a distinction must be made from a philosophical point of view between moral and ethical values on the one side and legal requirements. You see, the fact that there are certain international requirements does not necessarily mean that they contain ethical values or even moral values. So let us look first at the situation of the code wars, the weaponization of codes and cyber warfare. Here I'm going to examine first economic warfare and then I'll look at military warfare, although military warfare is often used for economic reasons. Now, the weaponization of codes is really the most significant development of warfare since the weaponization of fissile material. It creates a domain of warfare of offensive and defensive measures, because you can use these the artificial intelligence to defend yourself as well as to attack. For instance, in 2012, Iran cyber attack on Saudi Aramco with a virus designed to wipe out the memory of this company had the potential of causing great economic damage. This had already been done in a number of countries. For instance, Estonia was the first victim. The Russians were mad because Estonia had displaced a statue of a war hero, which was Russian. And so they attacked all the banks by distributed denial of service. So there were so many people trying to get some information from the bank that it was paralyzed. And it stayed paralyzed for several weeks so that you couldn't get any service from the bank. And then you had the case of Canada was attacked several times, the USA, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and in the Ukraine, which is quite interesting because in the Ukraine, years before the Russia, indirectly attacked the Ukrainian, the government computers of the Ukraine had been penetrated by the Russians by a cyber attack. They had different ways of doing it. I'm not going to go into these details, but you're going to show us something after. Now, such attacks, which use different type of malware, which Mark is going to demonstrate in a moment, compromise confidentiality by stealing and releasing information, like credit cards. Remember, in the United States, there was a big company, and name escapes me at the moment, which had all its credit card information stolen, and this caused, in fact, the stock market of that particular company to go way down.
It was Yahoo?
And created a lot of problems. And social security numbers, denial of service, attacks on against the bank. I mean, what would happen if suddenly all the stock market information, for instance, in New York or in here in Toronto, were wiped out? You can imagine what would be the consequences. Now, what's interesting is China is not that anxious. They want our secrets, but they're not interested in disrupting our infrastructure. And the reason is very simple. They have invested so much money in Canada and the United States that it's not in their interest. So in fact, we're sort of protected against the worst of cyber attack from China, because it will be counterproductive as far as they're concerned. On the other hand, when you talk about Iran and Iraq, Iran and North Korea, they don't have the same approach, and on many occasions, they have penetrated the banking system and other important infrastructure. I mean, you could very easily completely destroy the system of electricity. You could also for the airplanes, and so on. I mean, it could be very serious. And here, what we are talking mostly about terrorists and states, and what if, for instance, another example, remember last week, 2 weeks ago, I spoke to you about cars, autonomous cars, and what if in the case of self-driving car, what if they penetrate the system and suddenly stop the car in the middle of traffic, or if another case, for instance, in the case of a patient in a hospital and you stop the pacemaker that they have in their heart, or in the case of a home care robot which is being hacked. And what about also hacking the GPS, so that you have your GPS, it's being hacked, it's changed, and you go to the wrong place, and so on. So nice. Here we're more in the civil field, and we'll see
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, just on the slide here, I don't know if you guys can read too well. Just I thought that this was kind of a nice representation of, kind of the common stages of a cyber attack. So I don't know if you can read there. So who may be attacking you? Cyber criminals. I mean, these may be state sponsored. They may be just random individuals. They may be activists, let's say. You could have industrial competitors. You could also have, just random hackers, hacktivists, and then also employees. I actually worked in cybersecurity for a little bit, and what was actually interesting is the statistics actually show that typically breaches occur most commonly from employees that are already in the company rather than external threats that are actually coming in, which is kind of like counterintuitive. This is kind of interesting as well, where you kind of see the cycle. You have a survey where most of the time, before a cyber attack occurs, you'll have a lot of kind of research and reconnaissance that goes on around the particular target. So this could actually, happen where somebody is watching a particular employee coming in and out and what credentials that employee has. And then you have the delivery where the credentials of the employee are compromised. So it's email, let's say. Typically, email is where a lot of cyber attacks begin. They are able to enter the corporate email system of the company. You have the breach. And then typically, there was a case that I worked on when I was working in cybersecurity that was quite interesting, where a CEO had their email breached, and somebody posed as the CEO within the system, but didn't do anything, was actually in the system for about 2 years just watching and understanding who had credentials to what, who had the proper authorizations to authorize money transfers and purchase orders and things like that.
This would be the Trojan horse.
And so after 2 years of observing what was going on, getting all the credentials, understanding the cycles of who does what when money gets transferred, they then affected the system where they authorized a fraudulent transaction. And it's extremely, I guess you could say, disruptive to the business. In this particular case, the one that I was working on, the money transfer was made. This is a business that does about $1 million in revenue, or sorry, not a million, about $100 million in revenue per year. And this money transfer that was authorized was about $20 to $30 million, I believe, that was transferred out to an unknown account, gone. When we came in to kind of clean up the pieces, that business ended up going under. They had to declare bankruptcy. They weren't insured against that properly, and you know, it was a complete collapse of the business. So it's definitely not a minor threat. One other thing I just wanted to point out before we move on here, I was actually reading, this is a 2016 report by PricewaterhouseCoopers, which actually was on specifically mapping economic crimes. And right now, what the survey actually found was that the top economic crimes going on globally, and this is a survey that was done from global companies all around the world, the first is asset misappropriation, the second is cybersecurity risk. So it's a real thing, it's happening, it's, you know, something that's very much on the radar of CEOs, but only about 37% of organizations have a cyber incident response plan. And I remember when I was working in the cybersecurity industry, there was this old adage, and this is what we would always tell executives, that if somebody wants to get in, they will get in. It's, you're guaranteed going to get in. The question is, how are you going to deal with a penetration once it's happened? How can you isolate it and ensure that your data isn't corrupted, compromised once they're in? Because chances are they're already in.
Now, I should add that, Matt, you should perhaps you should have given my part of the lecture on this year when he was at McGill. He wrote his mini thesis on cyber warfare, and it was one of the first things published in Canada in the Journal of Law and Technology. So,
well, I mean, really, it was fun to write, but what was more interesting was actually working in it. But anyway, so we can
Well, as you can see, I mean, this opens an almost unimaginable new set of vulnerabilities, but also openings for cyber attacks and cybersecurity experts. Unfortunately, in Canada and the USA at the moment, there is a lack of top cybersecurity personnel, which means that cyber attacks against these countries pose a much greater long-term threat to national security than terrorism. It's much more dangerous than terrorism, because if you compare the number of incidents of terrorism in both in the US and Canada compared to the numerous cases of cyber attack, you can't even compare it. It's more than 10 to 1. Now, cyber attacks are also used in concert with traditional military operations. For instance, Daesh in Syria and in Russia, in Ukraine, and so on, were other example, or the case of Israel when dismantling the centrifuge in Iran. But cyber combat is distinctly a new form of conflict where norms, as I said earlier, of warfare developed prior to the discovery and application of artificial intelligence are no longer relevant. However, there are still a few rules of international law that are relevant, of the old, what I would call in quote, the old international law that could be relevant, and we're going to examine that in a minute. On the other hand, any country or any rogue group of individuals or even a lonely wolf can develop offensive capability, cyber capability. And this is the scary part, because to create a cyber weapon, all you need is a computer, an internet connection, and some coding skill. That's all you need. So that all you need is what you see here. And then, as I said, you know, coding skill and connection with the internet. And this is the thing that you were mentioning, the question that you cannot prevent a cyber attack. Well, you can prevent it by not being connected to the internet.
Yeah, it's funny, there's a few people that I actually worked in the industry that actually had like multiple firewalls and like virtual private networks that they would set up on their cell phones and on their emails. And some of them, essentially, it's rumored that Vladimir Putin has never sent an email, ever. He only communicates via phone and via letter. It's incredible. So there are people in the industry that are well aware of that and who go to great extents to protect themselves from being connected in some way.
And also another thing is to encrypt your message, but to encrypt and decrypt. Now when you have these supercomputers, even if you encrypt a message, first of all, it takes time and therefore money. It would take, when you have this new Chinese supercomputer that makes quadrillions operation in less than a second, when they can decrypt quite far, because they will try all possibilities, and in 1 or 2 seconds they can find out what the encrypted message contains. There's another thing that that I mentioned is the cloud. You see, there is also that possibility that the cloud can be penetrated. So people who put all their information in the cloud, well, it's not any more secure than having it in your own computer.
Yeah, I mean, that was just something I wanted to point out here. Has anyone heard, or maybe all of you have heard of the Internet of Things?
Yeah.
Sort of like a catchphrase that people are using now to sort of describe the phenomenon of connectivity, right? So we talk about like smart cities, smart cars, smart phones. It's just another way of saying that we're using data to better understand a lot of the tools and processes that are existing in our society. And so I just wanted to sort of put this up there because it kind of goes a long way to understand what sort of value the Internet of Things wants to sort of present, where, you know, you have the devices which are connected at point one, the data sensing collection, data transport and access, data analytics, data value. So this is what we're deciding what action to take, and then the actual value that it brings to human beings, so through experiences and whatnot. And so at any, well, maybe not the sixth, but at any stage in this virtuous cycle here in the Internet of Things, you can have a penetration and a breach. And I think that's what we're getting at there.
Just to add to that for a second.
Yeah.
That's what the, I'm trying to remember, was it Facebook that was hacked about a month, or bombarded about a month and a half ago, brought them down from a denial of service?
Mm-hmm.
It was through the point one there, device connection. People, the hack was basically nobody puts passwords on their smart fridges and smart thermostats and so on and so forth, and it was a bombardment from IoTs.
Okay, right. They had a whole thing of devices like that they had gathered through like mundane devices. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, like the fridges and things like that. Yeah, that was an interesting one.
Another thing too is that it's difficult to trace the use and development of cyber weapons, which is due to the fact that the non-physical nature of cyber conflicts. You see, national borders have no meaning when it comes to stop hackers. So it's very difficult to get to know which where it comes from and at what time and so on. Until definition and boundaries for cyber conflicts are set, cyber domain is still the Wild West. At the moment, we're at the mercy of it. In the meanwhile, cybersecurity will soon become the central feature of all products, whether digital or not. I mean, even now you have clothes that are becoming digital too, so glasses and so on. So as a result, you see the fastest and biggest industry being developed in the world is labor-intensive cybersecurity. About 10 countries have nuclear weapons, but any country can have cyber arms at little cost. In the USA, cybersecurity may become the next military and industrial complex, because this is the future. And cybersecurity is most important, and the job development in that field is great, because everyone can be hacked, and everyone needs security measures. But still, as you pointed out, we haven't reached a point where it's foolproof. Let's now go to lethal autonomous weapons. And lethal autonomous weapon systems, which are called sometimes killer robots and drones, raise important issues. For instance, can an unmanned, fully autonomous robot or drone reliably separate soldiers from civilians on a battlefield or elsewhere? Would their lack of human emotion prevent them from showing mercy and compassion to soldiers that are wounded on the field, if there are a few soldiers left, human soldiers? But what happens when people are surrendering? Would the robots be able to deal with that? In other words, what is very important for computer engineers and programmers is to develop the software or source codes that contain new cognitive modules and skill which will enable robots to have emotions, to feel emotions such as compassion for human or even for other robots. Now, I mentioned that earlier in the lectures as well, at the very beginning, as to whether or not a robot should feel emotions, and people are working on that at the moment. However, since the science of robotics has not yet reached the physical limits of technology, it's probably that within a few years, future programmers will be imparting to robots legal and ethical values based on international humanitarian law. Another important issue is whether autonomous robots or drones equipped with a quick draw response can be trusted. I remember in the first lecture we dealt with this question: what about robots that will say no to the people manipulating them? And so what can you trust a robot on the battlefield? More generally, will war waged by remote control become too easy and too tempting, since robots will save human lives by dispensing with the use of humans on the battlefield? Now, knowing only, you know, that the people at risk are robots, it would seem to me that there would be very little incentive to try to find other methods of settling disputes. Why bother about diplomatic conversation? Why bother about other methods, signing convention and things like that? So war could become trivialized as a global spectator sport to be watched on the computer, to be watched on your phone, on your iPhone, on television. It's becoming a sports fun. You know, it reminds me of and the gladiators at the time of Rome. People enjoy going to the arena and watch the gladiators fighting each other and killing each other. And so if we make it too easy, if no humans are ever involved in the battlefield, then we get desensitized. This may or may not be a good thing, you know. So now, considering the large number of states that are now working on autonomous legal weapons, including robots, in 2013, there was a meeting of the contracting state to an international convention that deals with the prohibition or restriction on the use of conventional weapons which may be excessively injurious or have indiscriminate effects on civilians. And here the it's called the LAWS, L-A-W-S, and this group is working, and Canada is part of the group, to determine to what extent we should authorize or control weapons of mass destruction of that particular nature. And the consensus that seems to appear is that with matters of life and death, it should not be delegated to machines. Machines should not. There should be someone that will direct the robot or the drone to do the killing of other people. So, in other words, a human operator should always be involved. But not everyone agrees to that. And now there have been precedents. For instance, chemical warfare is outlawed by that convention in a special protocol. Biological warfare is also prohibited. Nuclear weapons have been, that's a special treaty that deals with that, the use of which has been banned, or in the case of nuclear weapon, restricted. The difficulty would be to enforce such prohibition or restriction, because practically, as we have seen, any computer engineer with a personal computer could work privately and secretly for states, even signatory states. This is one of the concerns about Iran, for instance. They have signed that that agreement last summer. The question is whether they can just secretly, not work, because it doesn't take much now to produce uranium that is sufficiently strong to trigger an atomic bomb is one thing, but just the artificial intelligence system that controls them could be developed quietly, and as we've seen, it doesn't require much equipment. Now, the European Union has also dealt with this question, and I'm going to mention it in a moment. Now, the other thing is how can we control the development of these lethal autonomous weapons? Well, we can resort to international as it exists today, because at the moment, I mean, the use of partially or fully autonomous lethal weapon system is not absolutely prohibited, since there is no convention. They're working on a convention to that effect. But there is still international customary law which can, to some extent, attenuate the impact of the use of such weapon. For instance, the right of belligerent to adopt means of injuring the enemy is not limited. Robots, drones, and other lethal, partially or fully autonomous weapons must comply with the rules of distinction, proportionality, military necessity, and humanity in the conduct of a civil or international world. Now, what is the rule of distinction? Well, the rule of distinction is that you have to distinguish when you are carrying a military operation, you have to distinguish between civil and military target. You're not supposed to attack a civilian. This is the problem at the moment in Iraq, in Mosul, where the center of the city is so tightly packed with people that it makes it very difficult for the Iraqi forces to attack by airplane or helicopter, because they would kill a lot of civilians. And this is what ISIS is counting on. They have they don't care as far as they are concerned about these rules of war. The proportionality rule is that you have to carry out military operation proportionally to the objective. In other words, you cannot use an atomic bomb to destroy a building. It depends on the circumstances when you can use special weapons. The rule of military necessity is also similar. In some circumstances, you may be able to injure civilians, but it's a very restrictive. It's actually something which depends upon the interpretation that you can give to this concept of military necessity in the circumstances. So again, the whole idea is always to avoid collateral damage to civilians and their property. Now, the use of force must not be excessive in relation to the advantage anticipated. Now, these rules are quite important, they have been observed in some cases and not in others. You see, for instance, the rule of humanity, which holds that belligerent but also evaluate means of warfare according to the principle of humanity and the public conscience, has not always been followed. Take the example, I just saw a movie there, which is the a Danish movie on the sand of mines, and there, after the Second World War terminated, a young 14 and 15 year old a German that had been conscripted at the last minute at the end of the war and hadn't participated at all with military operation were used by the Dutch, by the Danes, to demine the beaches of Denmark, where they were they were expecting the Allies to disembark, and most of these young kids were killed because they had nothing. They were crawling on the sand with a stick there in order to find where these mines were located. Well, this is today, at least. But even there, under the Geneva Convention, you cannot use prisoners of war to do these things. And so it's, again, a question of whether you observe it or not. Now, the International Criminal Court could be used, but it would be very difficult because it only deals with natural person. Is a robot a natural person? And that depends. Once a robot has attained intelligence similar to that of humans, then you could consider them as human individuals and then hold them responsible for crimes against humanity or war crimes, which would be under the jurisdiction of the International Court. Well, the International Court, unfortunately, is getting into trouble at the moment because a lot of African countries feel that it is biased against them and are trying to withdraw from the court. But besides that, I mean, who could be held responsible? The programmer, the superior controlling the machine, the military commander employing this method of warfare, the political leader, the head of state? Again, it depends whether you're dealing with semi-autonomous robots or whether you're dealing with fully autonomous robots, in which case then they make their own decision and you cannot pursue them. You cannot pursue the states, although you could use consider them as mercenaries, and like in the olden days, then the people who use them, even though they are autonomous in their action, would be responsible. another way of controlling robots these type of weapons would be to resort to the civil responsibility of states. If a state uses lethal weapons and violates international law, they could be held responsible, not under the criminal court, under the jurisdiction of the criminal court, but just for the damage that is caused. So that there have been many examples in the history of international law where states have been held responsible for the way in which they have acted with respect to activities, military activities. A good example, some of you may be familiar with that case, was the case involving Nicaragua at the time of President Reagan, where the Contras were sent there to fight the communists in Nicaragua. And Nicaragua sued the United States on the ground that it was illegal to send Contras in Nicaragua, and therefore, because they were armed, the U.S. would be responsible civilly. Now, the U.S. won the case eventually because, in fact, it was shown that the Contras were acting independently, even though they had been armed by the U.S., acted independently from the United States. There is also Article 36 of the Geneva Convention, Protocol 1, on the protection of victims of international conflict. That said, but that's a little bit laughable, that a state adopting a new weapon should ask, should determine whether or not it's prohibited by international law. And what are the sanctions for that when there's none? I mentioned the European Union. Well, the European Union has the same concern as to whether or not there should be restrictions or even elimination of autonomous weapons of mass destruction. And there hasn't been really a movement in favor of eliminating these weapons. They just recommend restriction rather than outright prohibition. But at the moment, with all the trouble that the European Union is involved with Brexit and maybe Frexit or Grexit and so on, the final decision will be left to the 28 or less than 28 members of the European Union. But there is the same concern, you see, as to whether the unmanned autonomous weapons should be able to do whatever they want. They want the European Union would prefer to see them under the control of one of the belligerents. Another, finally, what are the possible solutions? Well, the one that Matthew and I recommended in an article that we have written on the international aspect of of the international aspect of robotics is to do like it was done with respect to the various projects that were under the sponsorship of the United Nations and which required the cooperation of all the states, you know, and that would be much better because this is what was done, as you well recall. The International Space Station is an example. The Human Genome Project is another one. The Large Hadron Particle Accelerator. Here, you see collaboration maybe among the states of the world would be much better and avoid competition. And then the results, the creation of these robots, then would not be lethal, and they would be much more profitable. And what would happen then is that from an economic point of view, the various states could license or, well, obtain a license to use them for peaceful activities, and it would be a much better
approach. It's basically a situation where prohibiting and restricting this type of research is extremely difficult, right, from an international standpoint. And outright banning it is really almost, I mean, it's impossible. I mean, you can imagine the kind of competitive advantage that this type of technology would give to a particular state in the sort of development of their military capabilities. And so, you know, my father mentioned that one option is to sort of have all of members of the United Nations sort of collaborate on this type of research. You know, the precedent that he mentioned, space station, human genome product, project. There's another really great example that's going on. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with, I'm sure you are familiar with Elon Musk, Andreessen Horowitz, a couple of other big VC guys in the Valley, in Silicon Valley, are basically, they launched a project called OpenAI, which is essentially like an open source, collaborative research project that essentially aims to make artificial intelligence research open and sort of provide equal access to all, right? And so the idea is that, you know, large companies have signed on. I believe Microsoft, I mean, obviously Tesla has. There's a bunch of other ones. I can't remember the exact list, but there's some pretty significant names on that list. And this is kind of like a precedent that I think, well, we think could be used, you know, on a more sort of broad international level to say that, well, we recognize the significance of this type of technology, we recognize the change that it can make from a military civil perspective, and you know, we're willing to collaborate on its development so that everyone can benefit, and then also that, you know, we always know where we stand in terms of, you know, how the research is progressing.
Well, there's a precedent already existing with respect to the bottom of the ocean and the subsoil. This is to be exploited for the benefit of mankind. It's considered the same as the moon, for instance, has been set aside as for the benefit of the common heritage of mankind, and any profit that would result from the exploitation of the resources of the moon or the bottom of the Pacific or Atlantic Ocean and so on would be then split and used by the countries which are developing countries in order to help them to improve their way of life.
How realistic do you guys think it is to actually say or establish that advancements and, you know, the latest developments in artificial intelligence research would be the common heritage of mankind? What do you guys think of that? Any ideas? I think that's possible? I think how would people accept that? Yeah?
Why not? I mean, we did collaborate on going to space.
Right. Yeah,
collaborate on
absolutely.
The International Space Station.
Right. So you would think that when you say why not, we could compare. I don't know if you've heard of the term singularity. Have you heard of this?
Mm-hmm.
So singularity is the moment when an intelligence greater than man's emerges, right? And the reason why it's called singularity, the term itself comes from a black hole. So in a black hole, there's a moment called singularity where the laws of physics don't apply anymore, and they call it like the event horizon, meaning that when the laws of physics don't apply anymore, you don't know what to expect. Like, there's no the regular laws that govern our world from a human perspective don't apply anymore. So like, there's no way to predict what's going to happen. And so when we talk about singularity, the emergence of artificial superintelligence, and that's intelligence beyond that of a human, we say, okay, well, if this singularity arises, then the laws of physics that govern our world no longer apply. What then? So I think it's interesting to say that. I mean, it's clear what the significance of that moment would be, but I think it's interesting to say that, okay, well, this is potentially the common heritage of mankind, right?
Yeah, it would become a project to for, you know, the international community to achieve that singularity, rather
right.
than having one.
If they deem it to be
yeah.
something that they would even want. That's something that I'm going to chat about, actually, in the next part of the lecture. Yeah?
But in reality, if we take a look at what's going on now between, shall we say, Russia and
mm-hmm.
Why would they start to share now when they haven't shared anything?
Yeah.
Well, virtually, I appreciate the man, you know, space station, international space station, but save and accept that. There's very little that's been shared, particularly in advancements, where there could be an advantage to a country or a society by not sharing.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to cause them to do this?
I think there's a couple of things, right? I mean, I'm going to talk about this actually in my part after the break, but if you actually think, you know, there was a real possibility in the 50s of a nuclear holocaust, right? You had technology that had been developed, you know, that could potentially and still can wipe out all of civilization, right? And so there's a lot of fear in the 50s that, you know, during the Cold War or whatever, there would be a potential nuclear holocaust and we would all be wiped out.
And the doomsday clock is moving closer to midnight again.
Yeah, that's arguably, well, actually, the doomsday clock is moving closer to midnight, I would argue. I'm going to talk about this in the second part of my lecture.
Okay.
For humanity, because of developments in robotics and artificial intelligence, right? And so I think I'm making that parallel because what I'm saying is that humanity, I think there's a precedent for the realization and the recognition at a certain point that certain technologies have the potential to be so disruptive and cause such great harm to humanity that maybe everyone steps up and says, we need to collaborate on this, or else, you know, one person's advantage is everyone's destruction. Like, we could argue that nuclear weapons are, or they are, right? So that's what I would answer. Yep.
Suppose you create this world
Yeah. Where this one, this particular one here?
No.
Yeah.
Where you've got
yeah.
Singularity, super intelligent
right.
robots, and they're all fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're fighting, they're fighting each other.
Right.
So you end up with a pyrrhic victory. And then what? Mm. They're not reproducing.
Right.
I mean, is that it?
No, I think you raise an excellent point, and I'm going to talk about this in the second part of my lecture. I'm going to start with essentially, and this is great because this really prefaces it really well, and I think we'll just have a break before we go. And because I want to sort of push this idea that you have here, where, you know, if we agree, or at least, you know, operate under the assumption that this kind of thing is a possibility or it does occur, you got to ask, well, is this a world that we even want? Maybe that will be self-limiting in itself, right? Where people say, okay, well, like pushing this research to its logical conclusion and having this kind of stuff emerge is something that we don't even want, right? So I'm gonna chat about that in the second half because I think these are questions that are really important to ask. So why don't we have, if you have a couple more questions, but then we can have a break and then I can get going. Yeah.
So in that project, the OpenAI project,
yeah,
any talks of actually coding in ethics?
I haven't, I'll be honest with you, I wish I had done, like, had a closer look at the actual work that they're doing. I know, you know, that they're, what their mission is, I know who's collaborating, but I'm not actually sure what in particular they're doing in terms of developing ethical and moral standards.
Maybe not them, but anywhere else.
Anywhere else.
Doing
any other institutions kind of coding ethics in the
AI? Yeah. There's a couple other ones. Send me, I think my email's on the sheet there, I can send you them, because that's definitely something that I was looking at in particular, so I can happily send that to you if you just send me an email. I can definitely send it over. Yep.
I was really curious about something you, Dr. Castell, mentioned earlier. You were saying that China is heavily invested in Canada, and I was wondering if you could say a little bit about where they're investing.
Well, they're invested, for instance, in the oil in Alberta and British Columbia.
Oil.
In
the
States.
Oil. Oil. And also in, I don't have the statistics here, but also invested in the factories and the mining, for instance, in Saskatchewan. You have some companies there. And also in Newfoundland on the east coast, they're not as invested in Canada as they are in the United States, where they have a lot of companies there that are operating both in China and in the United States.
So was it mostly that they're interested in the natural resource sector?
Yeah, there's a lot of investment in primary materials right now. I was looking at some of the investments in technology and whatnot. There haven't been a lot yet. So I'd say definitely a lot of primary resources. They actually tried to buy one of our main, like Potash Corp, recently, just 2 years ago or something. They tried to make a hostile takeover bid for Potash Corp, and the Canadian government blocked it. Because they deemed it to be like a significant Canadian strategic resource.
Real estate.
And they've been buying up real estate, you know, as you know, in Toronto, fueling the bubble and whatnot, in Vancouver as well. But that's more not from a state level, but from a an individual investor, you know, high net worth, buying that up.
Industrial and residential. I mean, they're
industrial and residential.
Yeah.
I don't know much about the industrial. I haven't heard about that. Have you heard that? Yeah.
Large buildings, massive real estate holdings.
Right.
Both in Canada and the United States.
I know a lot of what I've been hearing about the buying up of real estate holdings, and I think this is probably a little bit separate from some of the resource stuff that we were mentioning, is that Canada is actually, you know, believe it or not, seen to be one of the most safe havens to park assets in the world, just because we've got a very strong rule of law, our police is solid, quality of living's high, taxes are pretty average. It's actually a great country to live in.
A little corruption.
We're actually rated
solid at banking.
Solid banking as well. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not surprising, you know, given the amount of, you know, the unstable climate that we live in. There's a lot of countries that there's a lot of social, and also we have relatively very good social cohesion as well. This is one of the few places in the world that multiculturalism seems to be working. So there's a lot of interest from wealthy people all over the world to park money here. And that's actually happening. I was reading a piece. They do this study every year on where like the ultra wealthy are investing their money and moving as well. So where are they wanting to move? What are the top destinations to actually become a citizen of? And Australia is number one because it's very similar to Canada. And Canada is number two and the United States is number three. So it's interesting to see the interest that we're generating in terms of other nations and whatnot. Any other questions? And we can just take a quick break. Why don't we take a quick break and then, oh, did you have something?
Yeah, I was going to say that if we look at history, there has always been somebody who wants to dominate the whole world.
Yeah.
It's not going to change.
Yeah.
So we have to be prepared. I mean, I'm sure
totally.
That the people in charge, they know that.
Yeah,
someone
absolutely.
Someone is going to come up who will just want to disintegrate everything and be owning everything or whatever.
Yeah,
that's gonna happen.
I'm gonna chat about that in the second part of the lecture. I'm gonna talk about authority and where it comes from and where authority I think is gonna be moving in the new world with the advent of technology and whatnot. So we'll chat about that. Yeah.
On the other hand, if it's not the state interest alone in the artificial intelligence field, and there's an element of desirability if the private sector includes and invites everyone. All the scientists around the globe and say, even if you're from Somalia, come and be part of it.
Right.
I think there's an element of desirability to be part of something that's happening.
Yeah, totally.
And the states may have less control.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I'm going to talk about this in the second half of the lecture as well. There's kind of like, there's two camps, right? There's the techno-optimists, people that think that technology is just inherently good, and you know we can solve every problem only if we add a little bit more technology. And then there's the pessimists who, you know, like Elon Musk, who really understand the power of technology, but also the dangers as well. Meaning that there are limits to which you know more technological development for the sake of technological development leads us down a path where we sort of start asking questions and saying, oh, we don't really look around and we don't actually like the world that we're finding ourselves in. So I'm going to talk about that in the second half. So why don't we take couple minutes and 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and we'll be back. We'll get going. Thanks.